In the matter of Campo Verde versus NYNJ Link Developer LLC, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Kuzbin, on behalf of the division. Good morning, Chief Justice Ratner, William H. Merkin, ERG, NER Jr., Leary Fry, together with Frank Thompson of Babiani, Bonin and Hall, on behalf of respondent.
Good morning, Your Honor. Russell Apple from the Scalaca Law Firm, on behalf of Amicus, New Jersey Defense Association.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Mr. Confucione, please.
Well, thank you for hearing the case this morning. If I may, can I have 5 minutes of rebuttal, please, if I need it?
We'll gladly have you back on rebuttal, perhaps for a little bit less. And,
okay,
and
that's just fine, so you know, Judge.
I'm hoping, if possible, that we might be able to finish this argument before a lunch break. So
certainly. I'll be as succinct as I possibly can.
Wonderful.
Although I'm known to talk too long, so I'll really try to focus on it. I mean, the court asked the question, the way it phrased it, what is the applicable standard for determining whether a general contractor owes a duty to subcontractors' employees on a construction site? My answer is, respectfully, I think the factor analysis that the court laid out in Alloway is the standard. I think the court should abandon what Alloway called the general common law, which provided basically those three exceptions, the manner and means, the incompetence, and the nuisance. I think the court should abandon that for reasons I'll explain briefly in a moment. But I think the court should go further, I would respectfully submit, and just say that, you know, in a commercial construction context, as this case was, I think the court should clarify and hold that a general contractor or prime contractor, as it's sometimes referred to, has a duty of care to provide reasonable and adequate protection and safety to those working at the site, regardless of whether they're technically employed by a subcontractor or directly or independent workers, whatever it is. And the reason I say that is because, first of all, if you look at the Alloway factors, and the way I look at it is Alloway said that foreseeability is a major consideration. And in this case, for example, it's a 40-year bridge project. If you look at the deposition of the Link CEO, you know, he talked about all the responsibilities that Link had as the primary contractor under the Port Authority contract to develop the bridges. There's really two of them. And, you know, it's more than foreseeable. I would submit respectfully, it's almost a certainty that during a 40-year construction project on a bridge like the Gothels Bridge, you're going to have workers that are injured. So, I mean, that's almost a certainty. And if you look really at OSHA and the court in Alloway, again, I think they said that OSHA was, I forget if they said major consideration or significant. They talked about that OSHA is relevant to both actually the second element, which is the duty of care, which is generally for the court to decide, and it's also relevant to negligence. Here, we're only really concerned about the second element. But OSHA is a major factor, and in this case, OSHA, which is more of the modern trend, I would submit, puts the obligation on the general contractor for site safety, and actually it says it's a non-delegable duty. That doesn't mean the subcontractor doesn't have responsibilities either. It does, and I think that's important to distinguish. I'm not saying it's either one has to be chosen. My submission is that on the duty question, in a commercial construction project, the contractor has a duty of care. So why is that a better approach, in my opinion? Well, for one, I think, and again, I would focus on not so much the injured worker. It's better for him. It's another source of recovery. And I'll get into that a bit in a moment. But even if I just look at it from the general contractor standpoint, you know, and looking at it from a public policy standpoint, which I know the court has consistently said is important in all elements of determining duty in a negligence case, this is a much more predictable situation. So if a general contractor, you know, they do a voluntary undertaking. In this case, again, it was this decade-long project for millions and millions of dollars. It's much better from a duty standpoint to say you're responsible for site safety at the construction site than it is to basically say, which the old common law does, you're almost always not responsible. You don't even have a duty. But then in hindsight, occasionally a court will come in hindsight and look back at what happened and say, well, you're okay to basically make sure the contract's being performed by the subcontractor, but in involved yourself essentially in the means and manner in which the subcontractor carried out the thing. I would submit that's actually less fair to the general contractor, because if it knows it has a duty to provide reasonable safety at the site, it can plan in advance. And essentially, it's a voluntary undertaking in a contract. It's much better for the GC, I would submit, to have that. It's predictability under the law.
I know you used shorthand in the beginning of your argument, yeah. But it sounded like what you were saying was, this is a big project, costs a lot of money, going to last a good number of years. Impose a duty of care that's identical to the subcontractor in light of that. Is that your position?
Yes, it is.
Is that consistent with Alloway? Because it seems to me that you're rejecting the so-called common law rule because it always or almost always falls on one side of the line, but you want us to impose, no matter what the circumstances are, no matter who's in charge of day-to-day, the work site, who's employing the people and training the people, you're saying the general should always have that duty. So I would respectfully suggest that perhaps you're not asking us to adopt Alloway, you're asking us to adopt the mirror image of the common law rule.
Well, I guess I would say a couple of things. I think the factors in Alloway, I'm still saying, are the factors, because those expand beyond the construction context. But what I'm saying is, in a commercial construction project, the duty of care should just be found to exist, period, for the general contract.
That seems very inconsistent with Alloway, respectfully, Mr. Confucius.
Well, I guess I would say this, Judge. If you use the Alloway factors to gauge the duty of care in every commercial construction case, I think you would still have a level of unpredictability that I'm trying to avoid.
So you're saying not Alloway, right? Because you started out by saying it should be Alloway, not the common law, but then you're now saying that Alloway doesn't create sufficient certainty and we should just, no matter what the circumstances are, adopt a duty of care for the general?
Yeah. I'm saying that if you look at Alloway and apply those factors to this kind of a case, a general, commercial construction, you should just say there's a duty of care for the general contractor.
Has any other state taken that approach, either by case law or statute?
I couldn't find any. So this would definitely be a first for the states in the United States.
So foreseeability is at the center of the analysis. Mm-hmm. What is it about this case that satisfies foreseeability for the general contractor? What indication is it that the GC had knowledge of circumstances that would cause harm to your client?
Well, I don't know if you can. I think the level of specificity is one of the things when they talk about foreseeability in the old case law. It seems to me they talk more about, was the specific accident that caused the injury in this case foreseeable? I think that that's too specific. I think the court should clarify that a foreseeability analysis, again, in this kind of a case, encompasses more. Is it conceivable that safety violations will result in injuries to workers on the bridge?
That's not foreseeability. Foreseeability is not focused on the fact that people are going to get hurt if they work on, if a lot of people work on a project for 10 years, somebody's going to get somehow hurt. Wouldn't you agree that traditional foreseeability analysis in tort law is about what actually occurred? How foreseeable was that particular accident? I mean, it's not just foreseeability of some harm to somebody, because we could all be hurt somehow any day of the week. But it's the actual occurrence of the alleged tort. Was that foreseeable or not, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's generally right. Well, I guess in this case, right, if I look at the testimony of the CEO, the Link CEO, which I think is kind of important, I start with, okay, under the OSHA regulations, right, they had the duty of care. So if I start with that, one of the factors...
But that's a different topic. Yeah. Are you really asking us to change foreseeability, the factor of foreseeability, to be a general foreseeability that someone somewhere will somehow get hurt?
No, not in general. No, I'm not.
Well, then we have to focus on this accident, right? The way this gentleman was hurt was because of the excavator, and we know what that accident, so that's the focus of the foreseeability question, isn't it?
So if you stick with the Alloway factors, it's foreseeable that, I think one of the important parts is that it wasn't just that the excavator, they said, negligently operated the equipment and struck the plaintiff. It was also that there was a lack of a flag man or a signal man. I looked at some of the deposition testimony of the plaintiff, and that was definitely one of the factors in the case. And to me, the lack of a signal, if you look at the incident report, it says that there was no warning, essentially, for people that were working in the area that there wasn't a flagman or signalman to warn.
And why is that foreseeable for a general contractor who has made it clear in the contract that the site and the work and the training and the hiring and every aspect of the physical labor that's going on here is the responsibility of the sub, and that general contractor's representative shows up once a week to check on progress? How is it this particular accident foreseeable?
Well, again, I would, first of all, the way I read the record is it said that the link representatives walked the bridge daily. So it wasn't just once a week. I mean, this was a major project. But I don't, if you go to that level of detail, can you say that this particular accident was foreseeable? Probably not. But to me, I think that goes down too far in the level of the detail. I think the relevant question in this context, again, in a massive construction contract, is, was it foreseeable that, for example, if there's a lack of a flagman or signalman, was it foreseeable that somebody operating heavy equipment could injure one of the other workers? In this case, a laborer that was basically digging near a trench.
Can you talk a little bit? Oh, boy. Can you talk a little bit about the intertwined corporate relationships between the GC and the sub? So you mentioned specifically the representative of Link. Were there some people who were representatives of both? How were these entities separate or related?
Yeah, let me get to that part here, Your Honor. Well, essentially, from the way I read it, is that the actual, what I would call the subcontractor in this case, which is the KWM entity, was essentially made up of two entities. One of them, I think, was like 90% or 70% of the actual thing, and that was a Kiwi company. But then if you look under who formed the link, which is the New York, New Jersey link that I say is the general contractor, or rather the general contractor in my case, a 10% interest in that was from this Kiwi development company. So there's definitely an interplay, I would think, Your Honor, the way I see it, between the general contractor, which is the link in my scenario, and the subcontractor, which is the KWM.
Is there any information in the record about an overlap in executive staff, board members, directors, communication? I hear you saying, you know, Kiwet or Kiwi, yeah, however it's pronounced, yeah, is a 10% owner of one and a more majority owner of the other, but is there anything in the record about exactly how that played out?
No, I don't think so. I didn't see anything in the record that talked about that there were shared positions. In fact, the testimony of the CEO of Link, I think he was asked that question, Your Honor, and he said he didn't hold any positions in any of the Kiwi companies. So I think that's what the record fairly reflects there.
Let's go back a second to what you started when you opened with. You said there's almost a certainty that there's going to be an accident.
Yeah.
Right? And because of that, this test, the standard that you espouse would be appropriate. But that does seem so distinct from the application of either the common law three-part test or the Alloway test. And even looking at the restatement, which we adopted in Majestic, it says one who employs an independent contractor to do work which the employer should recognize is likely to create a peculiar, unreasonable risk. I'm not sure how it is that you reconcile the notion with we need a standard because all accidents are almost a certainty, mm-hmm, and this one accident must be a peculiar, unreasonable risk.
I really can. I think when I say you should abandon the common law, the old general common law with those exceptions, I think that's related to the restatement standard.
Abandon the common law and abandon the restatement.
Again, in the context of this kind of case, a commercial construction project. I think one of the things I guess I'm suggesting is, and I understand the court may not want to go that far. It may just say, we're going to stick with the alloy factors, and those are the factors that apply. Even under that scenario, I would still say that the court should clarify that we're not going to follow the three exceptions under the general common law anymore, primarily because they're not consistent with the modern trend reflected in OSHA and even this state's own regulations.
But think about alloy, right? So in alloy, you had a general that participated in the attempted repair of the machine that caused the damage the day before.
Okay.
The foreseeability of that seems so much more apparent.
It is. It is more apparent. But to me, I think that that's too narrow of a ground on the duty. What I'm really saying is this. If you look at the case law, if you look at the case law, some of the cases talk about, well, there's kind of the old general common law standard with where the general contractor just has no duty unless it's these three narrow exceptions, two of which seem like they almost never come up. I mean, the incompetent subcontractor, I guess, occasionally. The nuisance, I haven't even seen. So those two are largely irrelevant. It's mostly the manner and means. But like, even in this case, if you look at the way the trial judge analyzed it, even when he went to alloy and he said, but alloy says you also have to look at these factors, he kind of kept bringing back up the manner and means. So to me, the old common law standard, or whatever way it's referred to, the general common law, it kind of interferes with the way that courts are supposed to analyze it as alloy kind of lays it out. So even if you don't go as far as, and I admit my standard is aggressive, I think what I'm saying is, my standard is more predictable because I say my standard in quotes, but I'm really saying that
we refer to it as the Confusione
standard. I appreciate that, Your Honor. So under the Confusione standard, as the Chief Justice said, I'm really essentially saying that if you impose a duty of care on the general contractor, and this again in a commercial context, then the issue is, well, did the general contractor act reasonably? That's a much better place to make the assessment of whether there's a cause of action. When you do the duty of care analysis, as I said in the beginning, even for the general contractor, in smaller contracts, for example, a lot of times the general contractor goes in relying on this means and methods thing. Actually, if you look at this, at the testimony of the CEO in this case, he literally parrots that standard in his testimony in his deposition. He said, well, we didn't control a manner and means. It's kind of almost becomes like you're not really looking at the actual facts. So to me, now I lost my train of thought. To me, it's much more predictable to just say you have a duty under alloy. We looked at alloy, and it's clear in this kind of a context there's a duty.
But isn't duty a duty? If you read duty cases, not just in this context, but elsewhere, it's very fact specific. It's very much a product. If there's no statutory duty or something like that, it's very much a product of looking at the individual circumstances. Predictability is a nice thing, but if it imposes a duty that should not be imposed under the circumstances of the case, is that the direction we want to go? Just so that everybody doesn't have to come back to court and figure out if there's a duty? Predictability as sort of...
Well, I mean, ultimately, of course, that's up to the court. It's a question of law for the court to answer, revolving largely around the alloy factors and overriding sense of fairness. So if the court says, we don't think it's fair to adopt Confusion's ultra-aggressive approach, then fine. But
just renamed it.
I've modified it, Your Honor. Then you go back and kind of adopt the more conservative approach, which is, well, we're going to stick with alloy.
Counsel, can we move to another issue that you alluded to in your opening?
Sure.
And that is, how do you respond to the argument that this is a way to get around the workers' comp bar?
Yeah.
And have two pots? Go ahead.
So here's how I would respond to it. Workers' compensation law involves the relationship between, in this case, the plaintiff and the KWM entity, those two entities, essentially. So that provides the exclusive remedy. In this case, we're not talking about disturbing in any way that compensation scheme. We're talking about whether or not a duty of care should be imposed on a party that's, you know, somebody that's not a party to the employee-employer context. So it doesn't affect the workers' compensation law at all. And the other reason I kind of talk about Alloway a lot, or maybe the ultra-aggressive approach, is from a public policy standpoint, in addition to the other things I've talked about, you know, workers' compensation, yes, we understand it's kind of an exchange that the legislature has said. It said, well, we're not going to give you a cause of action, but you're going to get these automatic benefits, essentially. But they're not complete benefits that otherwise someone would get in a tort trial. They don't cover pain and suffering. And probably more importantly, if you look at the deposition of the plaintiff, he talked all about how he can't, like, do certain things with his children anymore. He talked about sports, and I think he said he couldn't do, I forget what it was, rowboating. He had certain activities, but those are factors that otherwise, you know, a jury would consider if it was an actual thing you could have a cause of action. So my point is, this kind of a case about whether or not and what extent the injured worker has a claim against somebody that's outside the employer-employee context is important, and it only adds. It doesn't really in any way interfere with workers' compensation law. Does that answer your Honor's question? Hopefully.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you wanted to add, Mr. Confucius?
Let me just check my notes real quick.
Go ahead.
I think I have one other question.
Oh, sure, Your Honor.
You were relying heavily, I think, on OSHA regulation 29 CFR 1926.16, which is the one that says the general contractor assumes all safety obligations, whether or not he subcontracts any part of the work, and cannot be, quote, relieved of overall responsibility for compliance with those safety requirements. Has any other court found that that creates a duty on a general contractor in and of itself?
No, and I don't think this court has said it creates a duty either. I think it only said in Alloway, it doesn't per se create a duty or obviously create a cause of action, but it did say in Alloway, it's a very important factor for a court to determine whether or not a duty exists. I guess I would just add this. I think what's kind of very important in this case is the CEO deposition testimony. I mean, if you looked at A585 in the record, speaking to Your Honor about this OSHA regulation, I mean, he said, did New York, New Jersey Link have any obligation with respect to ensuring the safety of the construction work? And he said, well, through contract, we subcontracted those responsibilities to KWM. I mean, right there, it's like, but that's not what OSHA is supposed to be about. It's just, it's inconsistent, I would say, with the whole modern trend of you can't just jettison away by contract your primary obligations as the prime contractor, which
that,
in this.
Does that even refer to OSHA, or is this about who has the contractual responsibility between the general and the sub to ensure the safety of the workers?
But they're not really different. I mean, the OSHA regulations about ensuring the safety of the site essentially are the same with what this deposition testimony is. He doesn't refer to OSHA by name, but the site safety and what OSHA requires in terms of site safety are identical. And OSHA says you can't just contract away your responsibility. So again, that's an important factor.
That's not this case. This is talking about a private right of action, not an issue as to whether or not someone could be the subject of an OSHA violation.
No, I understand that.
Contractor. That's a separate issue.
Totally agree, Your Honor. But the point is, whether or not you have a duty under federal law, in this case OSHA, is a significant factor for the court to determine, do you have a duty in tort? So that's the point. The fact that they have this non-delegable duty under OSHA is a significant point in my favor to say, well, they have a duty of care here. And again, I'll leave with this. One of the things that the opponent says is, well, you can't make the general contractor a guarantor of safety. Well, that's not what I'm saying. I'm only saying that, and again, at least in this circumstance, applying the Alloway factors, there's a duty of care. Whether or not the third element is met is a totally different situation. Did they act unreasonably, essentially, in carrying out their duty? And on that ground, the circumstances of the case are going to come into play. You know, if it's a massive construction project like this one, what a reasonable contractor in the circumstances of Link would do are going to be a lot different than, well, I had a small parking lot at an office building. It's a lot different. But I think it's much better to have that analyzed and assessed on that third element of breach than it is on the duty issue.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate the time.
Mr. Merkin.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Ravner, Associate Justices. I have the privilege of arguing this case on behalf of New York NJ Link. And I raise that at the outset only because if you look at the caption of the case and the manner in which the case was briefed below, there are a number of parties, all of whom are represented by the same counsel. And it appears, including at argument here and in the briefs, that really the only active arguments that are being made are against New Jersey Link, not against individual entities, not against the Port Authority, other entities that were addressed both by Judge Petrillo at the trial level and also by the appellate court. They were always sort of lumped together by the appellant, but and addressed separately by the respondent. But other than New York, New Jersey Link, none of them were addressed. As an initial matter, and not to minimize the importance of this issue, there is no basis in the record before this court or in the law to overturn the appellate division's decision as it relates to respondent. The question framed by the court in granting cert is, quote, the applicable standard of care for determining whether a general contractor owes a duty to a subcontractor's employees for purposes of determining liability for the injury sustained by a subcontractor's employee, end quote. In this case, the respondent is not the general contractor. And I heard a number of questions that were addressed to appellant where New York, New Jersey Link was characterized as a general contractor. They are the developer. The record below at the trial court and at the appellate level and in the petitions for cert never make an argument that New York, New Jersey Link owes the duty that would be assigned to a general contractor. There are no fewer than 25 places in those briefs where the appellant characterizes my client as the developer and the appellant characterizes the plaintiff's employer as the general contractor. So at this point, even if you look at the merits brief that the court permitted as a supplemental brief, it isn't even really said in there because they know judicial estoppel and other principles that would apply to this. You can't take that position at every level and then for the first time before this court now say, forget everything I said where I said they were the developer and my client's employer was the general contractor. I was just kidding. That's why I looked at the court's granting of this petition for cert as being a very significant one from the perspective of somebody that like I do, does this kind of work on a daily basis. I will acknowledge, and I'll take a point of privilege in saying that I have been following this case over the past number of months. And I was sitting in my office with Dave Deering, my partner, saying, man, I wish there was an amicus that I could get in here for, like the people that do this kind of work every day and care about this association. And then about a week ago, Friday, I got a phone call asking if I would be available to orally argue this today. And I readily accepted the opportunity because of how important this issue is, in fact, to people who are general contractors. But make no mistake, in this case, on this record, this court is constrained to affirm the decision of the appellate court as it relates to my client. They are not the general contractor. And nobody has ever said that, other than to the extent that it may be implied from the question that was framed by this court for certification. Addressing the manner in which this court decides to analyze the duty, as the court has indicated through its questions and as the papers indicate, there are sort of two overlapping ways that courts, including this court, have analyzed the issue. And again, what I would tell you is that regardless of what method the court determines among the existing methods, putting aside the Confucione one, which I will say not meaning to be pejorative, I would call the confusing one, there are two methods that are available. And if the court selects one or the other, as the developer on this project, there is no basis to reverse the decision of the lower court and vacate the grant of summary judgment to the party that I represent in this case. The case that most closely...
Mr. Merger, do I understand you to be arguing that the question presented that the court wrote was presented in this case is not actually presented because this case doesn't involve a general contractor and a subcontractor at all?
If this was an argument that was being made by a party without the court having framed the question this way, I would be arguing that it was a request for an advisory opinion. So yes, effectively, this court is looking at an issue that is not presented on the facts of this case. And one of the arguments that I want to address is, and I'll address it several different ways, is even if the court wants to address this issue, this is not the case to do it on
this
record.
There's no general contractor represented in the courtroom today.
No. And I'm prepared to answer all questions and argue it, because if the court is focused on this and wants to determine it, I want to facilitate that in a manner that's fair to all the parties, and I'm prepared to do that. But my first duty is to advocate for my client, and hands down on this record, given the characterization of my client in the record that's undisputed and in fact was embraced by the plaintiff, there is no question that the decision has to be affirmed.
So there it would be an advisory opinion then?
Well, again, respectfully, this court thought this was an opinion worth addressing. I'm saying that would be so if it were raised by a lawyer who wanted this court in the context of the developer.
But lots of things that we might think might be worth addressing might not be presented in a particular 100%. Case. And I understand you to be arguing that the relationship between a sub and a general contractor and where the duty belongs is not presented in this case, because there is no sub and general contractor. There's just a developer and a general contractor.
That's correct. The contract that's been referred to repeatedly as a longstanding lucrative contract, if the court examines that contract and it's part of the appellate record, and it was about 3 inches thick, and I read it carefully. This 40-year contract, it includes a design build of the Gothels Bridge. It also includes maintenance of the bridge over that period, and it further includes operation of that bridge. So it's a multifaceted agreement. It's not a simple construction agreement. Nowhere in that agreement is there anything that places any responsibility for safety on the developer. The developer hired a general contractor, as identified in the record, and that general contractor hired no subs but built the entire project themselves. And so all the people involved in this accident, all the people working out there on this function and other functions, were all employees of that same entity. And to your question earlier, Justice Wainwright, about the interrelationship of the companies, the New York New Jersey Link is a 90% an Australian company that's identified as in the record, and is strictly an investment company. The Kiewit company operates in many different ways for many different functions. The function that it operated for as part of the New York New Jersey Link is once again dealing with the finance element of this, as was acknowledged in appellant's argument, making reference to the testimony of the CEO. There was a completely separate entity, this is not a small family hold closely held corporation where the court might look at it differently. This is one of the five largest construction companies in the world. And
Kiewit, you're talking
yes,
about?
Yes. And so there is a completely separate entity that was involved in this event as one of the partners to the joint venture that acted as the general contractor, which was effectively made up of three different entities who had construction companies and came together to form one joint venture to accomplish this project. We see this if you're driving down any of the roads in New Jersey. You'll see Bishop Cinzeri, you know, that's J.H. Bishop and Cinzeri, or Bishop Cinzeri Gardner. There are multiple companies that do different things that come together for purposes of this project. And that's what was done. And so, I'm going to leave that there unless there's any other questions on it. But the closest case to any case that if you wanted to analyze, and again, I take the arguments as I find them. And so I'm not sure and don't have the right to ask what the court's purpose is in looking at the issue on these facts in this case. But if the court were to look at it under the case that's the closest, it would be the Muhammad case that's cited in both parties' briefs. In that case, New Jersey Transit was the owner of the project, and the entity that was involved was the independent contractor. And if you look at the factors in the Muhammad case, they are squarely aligned with the facts in this case. And I'm just reciting the ones that the court relied upon in supporting the dismissal of the claims based on the absence of a duty. New York, New Jersey Link exercised no direct control over plaintiff, exercised no direct control over the construction project. No orders were issued from New York, New Jersey Link to plaintiff or plaintiff's employer related to this work. Plaintiff answered to KWM alone. Plaintiff, as KWM's employee, took direction from KWM management. Plaintiff received all, was hired by, received all training, materials, equipment, protective gear used on this project from KWM. Plaintiff was paid exclusively by KWM and ultimately received a workers' compensation award through his employment at KWM. So if you're, if the court pleases to look at it through the lens of, because if you go all the way back to the beginning of time, it's, this all starts with what is the duty of a commercial property owner with regard to business invitees on the premises. And there's the concept that applies to both a landowner and a general contractor that forms the basis for the law as it currently stands at common law, which is that if you, as one of those entities, hire a general contractor, an independent contractor, I should say, to do the work, and you don't involve yourself in controlling, retaining control of the means and methods and manner of the work, which certainly wasn't done in this case, hire an incompetent contractor, not even argued at this level, or per se nuisance, again, conceded and not even argued at this level, there is no basis for holding that entity responsible for the injury to an independent subcontractor.
You identified a number of things that your client did not do. In 2013, when the Port Authority entered into a contract with Link, what were Link's responsibilities?
One of Link's responsibilities, and I think the one that might be most pertinent to the court's inquiry, was design and construction of the replacement bridge, which would include demolition of the bridge. But it was never contemplated that they would actually be that company. And again, that's why the record on this is such a...
What does that mean? They were, they entered a contract to design, construct, finance the, you know, this project. So what does it mean? There was never, it was never contemplated that they would do that.
Because Justice Pierre-Louis, in again, and it's, I'm putting this in perspective as somebody deals with these cases every day, and the court has a number of cases that have been cited to it that include these kind of factors, which is why I think this is such a challenging case for the court to use to revisit this issue. Those contracts typically will include obligations with regard to what if you subcontract out work, who retains responsibility for safety, whether as between the owner of the property and the developer, there is even an assumption of responsibilities related to job site safety. None of that was present in this contract. You see things like the obligation to have a competent person on site, to designate a site safety manager. You see the requirement to provide a safety program.
As as your client's responsibilities.
If my client were to be considered similar to a general contractor, I'm interpreting your question as, and maybe I'm overreading it, the idea that the contract was design and build this. So if you undertook to build this, didn't you undertake certain responsibilities? And I'm saying those responsibilities are defined by contract.
But you're saying they're not in this contract,
absolutely
right?
Absolutely not.
So everything that you listed is not in this contract.
100%.
Okay, that's what I'm confused about.
And those things are in the contract with the general contractor. They
who is
have
the general
all those.
Contractor?
Say that again, Your Honor.
Who's the general contractor?
KWM.
And who engaged KWM?
New Jersey Link, the developer.
Can I go back to your first answer on this line of questioning?
Sure.
The question was, what were Link's responsibilities? And you said to design and construct.
I said build, but yes.
What does the latter mean?
It means to take all steps that are necessary to remove the existing bridge and replace it with another bridge. But developers undertake those responsibilities all the time without any expectation that they're actually going to be involved in the construction. And if the court is going to analyze this, whether it's under the traditional common law or the more liberal approach of Alloway, you have to look at the factors that are outlined in those cases as it relates to responsibilities that are fairly placed upon someone who's involved in it. None of those responsibilities were assumed by the developer in this case.
When you say developer as opposed to general contractor, you mean someone who is financing the project or like broadly overseeing the project, but not actually how one would conceive of a general contractor as doing the project?
I think generally that's so, but specifically in this case, we are the developer. The contract describes us as the developer.
What does a developer do? That's what I'm asking.
In this instance, the developer's responsibilities were over a 40-year period. It included the overseeing a project that would include removal of the existing bridge after, I think, construction of a replacement bridge. It included engineering of that bridge and design of it, whether that was done by it or through some other source. It included maintenance of the bridge over the life of the 40-year agreement, and it included operation of the bridge during that same time period. So it was a wide-ranging agreement that had many elements to it, but I'm not running away from the one of those elements was that there's got to be a bridge put up there.
So the trial court characterized in the transcript from the decision characterized the contract as under the terms of Port Authority's contract and NYNJ Link. Under the contract, NYNJ Link is responsible for designing, financing, constructing, operating, and maintaining the Gulf Coast Bridge replacement project. Is that inaccurate?
I think that's exactly what I've said. I think that's what the record reflects. But the question is...
So the trial court inaccurately...
No, I don't think... I think the trial court did accurately characterize the... You know, it's a several hundred page document, but I think that's a succinct, accurate characterization of it. But
so construction, designing, operating, maintaining the Gulf Coast Bridge replacement project.
Right. But again... You have a property owner that hires a developer. The developer then hires a general contractor. You can't run away from the fact that they are the general contractor. Whether this contract would create some obligation to them, if the court's going to look at it as it relates to my client in this case, as opposed to what we haven't really addressed yet, which is the global way to look at these cases generally, that the court framed as the question, there has to be some indication in the contract that they were contracting and retaining some obligation as it related to the job site and safety. One of the things that was said that I would respectfully disagree with in the record is the idea that there was somebody from NYNJ Link walking the site on a daily basis. I don't believe that's accurate. I think there's somebody that was walking it on a periodic basis, but for one reason and one reason only, to determine whether or not the project was being built in accordance with the plans and specifications, not to monitor the work, not to direct the work, not to oversee job site safety, not to control the means and methods or manner in which the work was being done, but simply as the developer to make sure that the authority was getting what it paid for by virtue of the plans and specifications and budget.
Can you clarify something? When Mr. Confusione was reading from the deposition of the CEO, that was the CEO of your client?
I believe it was, I'm not sure because it wasn't identified who he was the CEO of, but it's I believe, one of the representatives, yes.
Of your client?
Yes.
So to the extent that there's a representation that that's the general, that's simply a factual error?
I don't know that there's a representation. Respectfully, I think it's the way the court framed the question. If you look at every...
And by the court, you mean us.
I do, Your Honor.
Because here the trial court specifically said that Macari and Kiewit, I'm not sure how to pronounce them.
I'm not either. That's why, quote, I kept calling them the Australian
company. We're
simply
investors.
Correct.
So the trial court called your client investors, not the GC.
Well, certainly, yes, the 90% partner, that's the only thing they do in any facet of their business. They are a company that raises money for large projects. That's...
I thought it was because Macari is the 90% and the Kiewit is the 10%. So altogether, Macari and Kiewit are the 100%.
Of New York, New Jersey Link. Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
And that's what the trial court called. Those two were simply investors.
In that context, they were, Your Honor. Yes, as characterized by the trial court. So, if I may, in looking at the approaches that have been taken here, what's being urged upon the court, and it is a radical approach, and the answers to the questions candidly from appellant, there is no other state that does this. New Jersey has never done this. No other state has ever interpreted OSHA in the manner that you're being asked to do. And I'm going to address it because it's significant, but that's way beyond even the two approaches that sort of synthesized to form New Jersey's approach, an intersection between the common law and an approach that looks at OSHA a little bit. The approach that's being urged on the court is essentially a top-down approach. And it's the cases that are cited to suggest that that ought to be the approach is, and I want to address it a couple of different ways. that approach would have a catastrophic effect on the construction industry because it doesn't square with the realities of construction projects and it doesn't square with what OSHA is. In part, it ignores, and I'll grant you that one of the things that was said to you was, could you just look at this in the context of commercial construction? That's not an adequate way to look at it. Part of the challenge of looking at this case is that there are all sorts of construction circumstances that could include a general contractor. You could have a single family home. You could have residential construction that involves a development or multifamily units. You could have the traditional commercial construction that could involve construction of a new commercial building. You could have industrial construction, or you could have renovation to an existing structure. Each of those circumstances carry with it a very different relationship between the entities that are involved. And so when the court has looked at this from the bottom up in the manner that the court has looked at it, the general thought is that the best general rule is that when you are a contractor, a landowner, et cetera, and you hire someone who specializes in doing certain work, you have a right to rely on the fact, assuming you select a competent contractor and don't involve yourself in the means and methods of the work and retain control of those, you have a right to assume that they are competent to do that trade, that they're going to hire competent people, they're going to train them, they're going to reinforce that training, they're going to give them the proper equipment, they're going to give them the proper materials, they're going to give them the proper protective gear, and they are going to be there on the spot supervising them every moment while they do that specialized trade. This looks to place that responsibility on someone who has nothing more at best than general supervisory responsibility. And ordinarily, I would call out the citation to a number of unpublished appellate division decisions like has occurred in connection with the brief that was filed here, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to suggest that if you're really going to look at this issue, maybe you should look at those cases, not to look at the way they were decided or what the law was, but to look at the disparity of circumstances that are addressed in those cases, like the Lotta case, which addresses a single family residential home where the party that was hired to construct it made it clear to the party that hired them that they had no experience in any of the trades. They were hiring someone to be involved in doing the work the plaintiff was doing at the time of the accident. They did not know the safety requirements for that. They were not going to be present on the job. And in fact, they weren't present on the job. And under those circumstances, the court analyzed whether or not it's fair to impose a duty on them. If the court's going to look at it from a more general standpoint, it can't be from the top-down approach. The cases that discuss this, and I'll try to do it quickly, it starts with Bortz, it goes to Meter, it goes to Kane, it goes to Alloway, and it goes to Fernandez. And when I was looking at those cases, I think of any of those cases, the only one that was decided by this court or anyone who's currently on the court was there is Fernandez, which I think was Chief Justice Ravner and Justice Patterson. So it's the freshest of looks. So if you look at Bortz, and I'll tell you where this is very well summarized. In Alloway, there is a summary of the development of that law. In Bortz, at the time Bortz was decided by the court, New Jersey had adopted, the legislature had adopted, the Construction Safety Act. And in that Construction Safety Act, it specifically discussed duties for any contractor, whether it be a subcontractor or a contractor that could be characterized as a general contractor on the site. And it made a decision that because New Jersey's legislature had adopted legislation that placed those responsibilities, that it was fair to place those on the contractor in that case. Fast forward, Meter gets decided versus Resorts International. By that time, OSHA had been implemented by the federal government, and New Jersey had therefore repealed the Construction Safety Act. So it no longer existed. So at that point, there was no legislative expression of the intent to apply this to both general contractors and subcontractors. New Jersey's legislature, which since that occurred in 19, whatever it was, you know, Meter's 1984, but I think this is 1970, they've had all that time to adopt legislation similar to what was adopted before to try to place that responsibility and have declined to do so. In spite of that, the Meter court determined that there was a duty on a general contractor, and it was largely based upon a discussion related to OSHA. That discussion from Meter carried over into Kane. That discussion from Kane and Meter carried over slightly into Alloway by way of summarization, and even more in a more limited way in Fernandez. And this is probably the most important thing that I'm going to say today that I'd ask the court to analyze. That decision where they looked at OSHA is based upon a fundamental misinterpretation of OSHA. It is a fundamental misunderstanding, misapplication, misinterpretation. It's just not what OSHA says. In that case, Sports, Meter, and then in Kane, large reliance was placed upon the opinion of an expert that was retained by the plaintiff, who characterized the section 1926.16 A, B, and C as placing that non-delegable duty that's being sought. Your Honors, I think several of you asked questions related to that. So I want to be very specific.
Can you repeat the citation one more time?
Sure. I'm sorry. It's the citation that has been relied on in again in Bortz, Meter, and Kane, 1926.16, small a, small b, and small b, c. Those are the sections where if you look at those opinions, you're going to see language that talks about a contractor having that responsibility. So to be clear, and again, I'm not going to get into a long history lesson, but I want to do this as quickly as I can to get to the part that matters the most. Originally, prior to OSHA, there was the Contract Work Hours Standards Act, 1962, which was related to overtime pay. At a certain point, that was modified, 1969, to add Section 107 of the Construction Safety Act. And it was renamed the Contract Workers Hour and Safety Act. That applied to federal projects only. It did not apply to private construction or state work. It applied to federal projects only. When the government looked at that and decided we ought to undertake a more widespread approach to job site safety, that was what resulted in OSHA. And 1926 Section 12 of OSHA, small c, says as follows. Construction Safety Act, which is what we just discussed before, distinguished. The section adopts as occupational safety and health standards under Section 6 of the Act, the standards which are prescribed in Part 1926 of this chapter. Thus, the standards of Part 1926 of this chapter are applied. I'm sorry, I misread it. Thus, the standards, parens, substantive rules, end parens, published in subpart C, and the following subparts of 1926 of this chapter are applied. And most importantly, this section does not incorporate subparts A and B of Part 1926 of this chapter. Subparts A and B have pertinence only to the application of Section 107 of the Contract Work Hours and Safety Standards Act, parens, the Construction Safety Act, applying to federal projects. Subpart C starts at 1926.20. So those sections that have been relied upon and parroted by courts over the years.
But I'm looking at 29 CFR 1926.16.
Yes, Your Honor.
By contracting for full performance of a contract, the prime contractor assumes all obligations prescribed as employer obligations under the standards contained in this part, whether or not he subcontracts any part of the work. Then B, in no case shall the prime contractor be relieved of overall responsibility for compliance with the requirements of this part for all work to be performed under the contract. You're saying it doesn't actually say that, or?
No, it 100% says that, but that is part of subpart B. And I just read you that OSHA says only subpart C forms the standards for private industry. Subparts A and B are for federally funded projects under the Construction Safety Act, Section 107.
And so, sorry, where do I find that again? 1926.12?
What I read to you is 1910.12, small c. 1910.12, small c. So I'm going to just give you some other examples of why it's so inappropriate to.
Mr. Merkner, how much time do you anticipate remaining in your
I could do
argument?
This in, I'll speak quickly and do it in 5 minutes, if that helps.
Why don't we take a break?
Okay.
Because I want to be fair to staff and the many that put this together so that the public can view it. We'll take a half hour recess and be back at 1:15.